Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, which was an ancient name for Babylon, to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. The book of Daniel is written by Daniel. And we know that because in the later chapters, listen, it's not going to get better than that tonight. So I hope you... It's sad when you've used your best stuff in your first sentence. It's funny, though. Some people have such big brains that they don't know anything. And a lot of the commentators are like that. I acknowledge that laugh in the sense of I'm trying to be careful. One of the saddest times in my life was when the Far Side ceased its run in the newspaper. It was consistently one perky spot in the newspaper, and we're needing perky these days. I remember there was a picture, and it was on his calendars and all too, where this guy just, the school for the mentally gifted, this guy just a genius, you know, and he looked like a genius. And he's trying to get into the building, and he's got his hand up trying to push against a door that can only come in the other direction. And that's the way it is, I think. Some people are so smart that they can't match their socks. And a lot of commentators are like that, I think. This is a big dispute, this big argument over who wrote Daniel. And all through the latter chapters of the book, Daniel identifies himself by name continually. But here's the problem that they have. The prophecies of Daniel are so astounding and so exact that if they give him the dating that is recorded in the book and they identify him as the author, they've got to accept the fact that it is divine scripture, which is many of them aren't interested in. I'm talking about liberal commentators. And so now they've got to make him writing several hundred years later than he did, change his name, and he's really Daniel was just a name for several writers who wrote, and they go into this whole nonsense. You know, life is so easy when you know your God is as big as he is. He knows the beginning from the end. He knows what's going to happen. He knows our lives, the Bible says. He sees our lives as a tale that's been told. Like it's already over. He sees a rerun for him. Not anxious about my life at all tonight. Others may be. He's not anxious about your life at all. He sees it all of man's history. He knows how it ends. He didn't write and say, this is in the book of Revelation, this is how I'd like to see it end. He didn't do that at all. He knows how it's going to end, absolutely how it's going to end. And so he writes it down. One of the really difficult things that these smart people have to deal with in terms of attempting to say that Daniel is not the author of the book of Daniel is that Jesus, when he was giving his Olivet discourse in Matthew chapter 24 about the end times, he said in verse 15, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, and he's quoting from Daniel chapter 9, he identifies Daniel as the author of the book. I don't know about you, but that's good enough for me. That's pretty good for me. Daniel's the author. The first date that's mentioned in the book is in verse 1, is the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, and that was 605 B.C. The last date that is mentioned is mentioned in the third year of King Cyrus of Persia in chapter 10, verse 1, and that's 537 B.C. I'm expecting all of you to remember these dates. I mention it to you for this purpose. It lets us know that Daniel's prophecy and his ministry covered a period of over 70 years. He was probably in his 90s at the time that he wrote the latter portions of the book, probably when he was taken captive by the Babylonians. He was in his early teens. some venture a guess of being 14 years old. The setting for the book is the city of Babylon, the capital of the ancient world-ruling empire by the same name of Babylon. And Daniel's position in Babylon ultimately, as he came to the city as a Jewish captive from Jerusalem, but ultimately he becomes a very high official in Babylon, and he does it without compromising. It isn't long before he becomes like a cabinet member for the rulers. He becomes a chief of staff. And finally, at the end of his life, when Darius comes in and with the Medo-Persian Empire and establishes all of the things that he was establishing, he made Daniel one of the three presidents under Darius. One of the great values of the book of Daniel is because Daniel lived so faithfully to the Lord while living in a very secular environment and in the public sector. He's a valuable study on how to live for the Lord when you hold a secular job. And that's almost all of us in this room. When I hold a job where God has placed me in this world, even when it's not easy. Even when it's not easy. And you know, role models are very important to have as it relates to all of these things. Daniel's a wonderful role model. Joseph is also a great role model concerning that. The language of the book of Daniel is very interesting. You ought to know just a sentence or two about it because I won't spend any time on it as we get into the book further. Most of chapters 1 through 7 were written in a language called Aramaic. Virtually the entirety of the Old Testament was written in the language of the Jews, which was Hebrew, but most of chapters 1 through 7, specifically from verse 4 in chapter 2 all the way through chapter 7, was written in Aramaic. It was the common language of the world of that day, kind of like what our English is. It's the most predominant language of the day. And so it was written in Aramaic. Not much is written in Aramaic in the Old Testament, so that's interesting. It is written in Aramaic with all of the things that have to do with his time there in Babylon. And then from chapters 8 through 12, he reverts to the Hebrew language because the Hebrew people are the target of those prophecies that he gives in those chapters. There are two supreme lessons as it relates to the book of Daniel, though it teaches many things. But two, I think, that are the greatest in terms of application for our life. And one of them is how to live for the Lord in a completely pagan environment, especially when God has put you in a position of tremendous responsibility and the pressures associated with that responsibility. It can be done. And Daniel teaches us that it can be done, but more than that, he shows us how it can be done by how he lived his life. A beautiful lesson about how to be in this world, but not to be of this world. And we are not, we are in this world as believers, but we are not of this world. We are of another kingdom and another city that we're waiting for, the one that the Lord has prepared for us. The second great lesson of the book of Daniel is the sovereignty of God, and he keeps bringing it up all the way through. The sovereignty of God, it simply means that God is almighty, that he is all-powerful. Whatever is happening on the face of the planet, whatever kings rise up, whatever kings go down, whatever nations rise up, whatever nations go down, the Lord is sovereign over all of those things. And so it's a beautiful book about the sovereignty of God. In chapter 1 here, there's a couple of details that we ought to know just so we can get our bearings as it relates to the book of Daniel and the other prophets that we've been looking at. The technicalities. The nation of Israel had divided into two, as we have seen under when we were studying Ezekiel. Following Solomon's reign, his son Rehoboam came to reign. The people wanted some tax relief. He answered them harshly. The northern 10 tribes of Israel split away from the southern 2 tribes, established their own northern kingdom called Israel, and left the southern 2 tribes of Judah and Benjamin to make their own little country called Judah. They were all Jews, but it was a divided kingdom at that time. And the northern kingdom of Israel never had one good king. of one godly king the entirety of their history. And because of that, their decline was more rapid in terms of sin than the southern kingdom of Judah. And they fell into captivity because of their sin to the Assyrians in 722 BC. The Assyrians were the world-ruling empire at that time. Isaiah the prophet ministered to the northern kingdom of Israel for the 18 years prior to their fall to the Assyrians, and then following that spent the remainder of his prophetic ministry prophesying to the southern kingdom of Judah in the hopes that they would not go the same way of Israel, but they did. And the southern kingdom of Judah fell to the Babylonians a little over 100 years after the northern kingdom had fallen to the Assyrians. Babylon, by this time, had replaced Assyria as the world-ruling empire. They had conquered them in 612 BC. Now, Israel was not a fun piece of land for the Babylonians to conquer and to rule. They had to conquer Jerusalem three times, and Nebuchadnezzar was just pretty upset about it the third time, and he just levels the whole city, just destroys the whole city, destroys the country, and says, all right, I won't have to come back and do this again. He didn't leave them anything to rebel with for a fourth time. The first rebellion of Jerusalem against the Babylonians occurred in 605 BC. It was in that first conquering of Jerusalem that Daniel was taken captive by the Babylonians, not in one of the subsequent conquerings that occurred. Judah and Jerusalem fell because of their rebellion against God. God warned them and warned them and warned them concerning their sin. They wouldn't turn from it, and God finally brought the destruction upon them. Daniel was taken captive in that first conquest of Jerusalem, the first of the three, and he was taken away into Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, we're told in verse 1, when Jehoiakim was the king of Judah, which was about 604, 605 BC. Daniel probably had been exposed, so we get a sense of who overlaps in all of this historically a little bit. It fascinates me. It may be tedious to some of you, but I have the mic. And so Daniel probably, during his young life in Jerusalem, had been in contact or had at least heard about the prophecies of Jeremiah. Jeremiah had been prophesying for many years there, over 40 years in Jerusalem, and Daniel, apparently raised in a godly home, given the name that he was given, which we'll talk about a little later, but probably had been exposed to the ministry of Jeremiah. Daniel, at the time of the writing of Daniel, the ministry of Daniel, he's a contemporary of Ezekiel. In the latter portion of Ezekiel's ministry. Remember in the book of Ezekiel, God took Ezekiel and made him a witness to the Jews by the river Chebar in a tell called Tel Abib. His ministry was to the Jews there. At the same time, Daniel, also a captive of the Babylonians, was 50 miles in the other direction in the city of Babylon, and he was being groomed for something entirely different. But Ezekiel mentions Daniel in his prophecy. So they knew about each other, apparently, though we don't know if they ever met. And so that's kind of the how and why of these four exiles, Daniel and his three friends, and how they end up in Babylon. And we pick it up in chapter 1 here. They're captive, they're in a strange land, and they're hundreds of miles away from home. God begins immediately with the theme of sovereignty in verses 1 and 2. He opens this book of Daniel with two very interesting perspectives of the fall of Jerusalem to Babylon. Notice in verse 1, he says, first of all, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Then in verse 2, he gives a second perspective of the same event, and he says, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hand. There's a description of the same events, but the first one describes what's happening in the physical realm, and the second one is describing what was happening in the spiritual realm. The natural man could only see that Nebuchadnezzar came in with his Babylonian forces and he conquered Jerusalem. God said concerning his people in the perspective that he wanted them to have and for us to have as his people, he's saying in effect here in the book, that's not all that happened. All that happens in our life is not what we can see. What is really happening in our life is what the Lord is doing. And one of the important things about our lives as believers in the Lord is to recognize his hand behind all of the physical things that we see going on around us. And so God says, you can see what was happening physically, but that's not really what was happening. What was really happening is what I was doing. And it wasn't that Nebuchadnezzar was conquering Jerusalem. It was I was turning Jerusalem over to them because they had been unfaithful to my word for 490 years, especially in the area of the Sabbath rest for the land. And the land deserves 70 years, the Sabbath year rest, 70 years of rest, and I'm going to give it to them by sending them into captivity, and I'm going to cure them of their idolatry because I'm going to give them idols up to their nose until they never want to see an idol again in their life. And it's a sure way to cure us of many things, and that is to say, all right, you want that? I'll give it to you until you're ready to throw up over it, you know, and that's kind of what he did. He took them to the land of idols, and it wasn't so romantic then when they were in the middle of it and had lost their opportunity to be in Jerusalem. And so this is the two ways to go through life. One of just only seeing the physical and then seeing God's hand at work sovereignly, always working, always working. And so often in our lives, we only see Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem and he besieged it. And I'm never seeing anything clearly until I see, and the Lord gave Judah into his hand. And so just in that quiet way, Daniel would have recognized it. The readers, Hebrew readers of the Bible would have recognized that God was whispering in these first two verses to his people that I'm at work. I was at work. It was a hard time. It was a difficult time. That chastening was a hard time. But I was at work in your life all along. The beautiful thing about that for our lives is he has promised to be just as active in our lives as believers. Just as active. Paul wrote to the Romans and he said, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God and are the called according to his purposes. And whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. God works all things together for good in our lives. If we love him and are the called according to his purposes, he will not allow anything else to have the final say in our lives. Except for him, not Nebuchadnezzar, not the most powerful man or the most powerful woman in the world. Why? Because God is sovereign. He's almighty. I remember hearing one guy speak one time on the sovereignty of God. I mean, he really got going on the sovereignty of God. God's almighty and God's strong in the whole thing. And I mean, and then nothing compares to his sovereignty and his almightiness. And it's a beautiful sermon that he was preaching. And then he said something. He said, you know, the sovereignty of God would terrify you if you didn't know that as a believer, he will only use his sovereignty for our good. For our good. He is sovereign. He is all-powerful. There's nothing that he can't do. But because we're accepted in the Beloved, because we're in Christ Jesus, he promises, as I read there in the book of Romans, he promises only to use his sovereignty, his almightiness, for our good. And so his sovereignty is a source of real encouragement and comfort to us as he's working in our lives. Notice in verse 3 that the king, Nebuchadnezzar, instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to take some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and come and some of the nobles of the royalty that had been captured from Jerusalem, young men in whom there was no blemish, no physical flaws, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace and whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for these that had been drawn aside for this purpose, he said, the king appointed for them
a daily provision of the king's delicacies. That's the good food. It's not the servant food. And of wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now, from among those of the sons of Judah that were taken were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And to them the chief of the eunuchs gave them new names. He gave Daniel the new name Belteshazzar. It's a little harder in kindergarten. And to Hananiah he gave the name Shadrach. To Mishael he gave the name Meshach. And to Azariah he gave him the name Abednego. So he changed the names. Now something is very, very fascinating that is happening in this passage, again, at least to me. Babylon is now going, and Nebuchadnezzar is going to attempt to take these captives from Jerusalem and to conform them into the image of Babylon. He's going to try and fashion them after the culture and the gods and the everything of Babylon. And the first thing that Nebuchadnezzar does here in these verses 3 through 7 is he enrolls all of these, including Daniel and his three friends, into the University of Babylon. That's what he introduces them into. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is a very smart man. His descendants weren't so good. But, you know, people are pretty sharp when you become the world-ruling empire. I mean, you got something going for you, typically. And Nebuchadnezzar was sharper than the average bear, or however that went. A little smarter than Yogi. And so he understood that when he plundered Jerusalem, that the most valuable thing in Jerusalem wasn't just the gold, and it wasn't just the silver, and it wasn't just the architectural finds that he found there, which he took anyway and brought back and put in his temples. He understood that the most valuable thing about that city of Jerusalem and about that nation was talented people. And so he nabbed them for himself. And everywhere he conquered in the known world, he nabbed those kinds of people. Notice in verse 4, he's got plans for these four Jewish captives. And he wants them to serve in his palace. Now, what that involved, we're told there in verses 3 through 7. Number one, he only wanted the brightest and the best there in verse 4. Young men in whom there's no blemish, good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had the ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom he might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. He only wanted the brightest and the best of these captives. This tells me that Daniel and his three friends met Nebuchadnezzar's requirements. They were handsome, and they were intelligent. And then he takes and he provides them with a daily provision of food there in verse 5. Not just any old food, but the king's delicacies and the king's wine. So he supplies them with food. And then in verse 5, we're told that he gives them 3 years of education. And then in verses 6 and 7, what he does with them is he changes their names. Now, something very fascinating is happening in all of this. What was really going on here is not an education, but an indoctrination. That's what Nebuchadnezzar is up to here. He is attempting to brainwash them and to conform them after Babylon. And the idea was to indoctrinate them, convert them to the ways of Babylon, then send them back to their native land of Israel, and then make them representatives of Babylon there in their homeland in order that they might keep peace there in the provinces of the Roman Empire. And he targets only the best, only the brightest for it. And he targets only the youth, interestingly enough, for it. And I think that it's very important to recognize, and especially if you're a youth or you're raising youths, he targets the youth for a couple of reasons. One is they're the future. They're always the future. You're the future. If you're young, you're the future. I don't flatter you. It's the way it is. Whatever the future is going to be, whether it's going to be good or bad, I don't say you're the good future or the bad future. I hope you're the good future.
but you're the future. The youth of any nation is the future of that nation. And it is a very wise nation that understands that their youth is the future. The Lord is the future supremely, but the youth is the future of a nation. And that they will then do what is necessary to raise up a generation that is ready for what is coming their way. Once a society or a nation loses sight of the value of the next generation and to train them for what's coming next, they're in big trouble, and we're in big trouble. We're in big trouble. And I don't speak of you in terms of those of you who are younger among us. It's been bad since I was in high school, which was 1973. We've been on a bad roll for quite a while, if you ask my opinion. So the youth is the future. And if we're not going to give them the attention that they need, and if we aren't going to train them into greatness for good things, there's always someone waiting to train them in greatness for other things that are not so good. I remember one time listening, and there's always this great debate that goes on in the body of Christ as it relates to listening to secular music and all of these things. And I have strong opinions about it, but I don't have the time to go into all of it. But I remember reading a book that I thought was just the height of sanity. And the guy said, listen, as it relates to just letting kids bring any kind of music into the house, or, you know, however ungodly or terrible it is as it relates to a Christian household. He said, if I went to a strip mall, and I mean by a mall of just shops. So we went to Raley's up there, here's all these stores that are part of the mall there, outdoor mall. And here's this guy that's standing outside there, and he asked if I would pick him up and then take him to my house and then put him into the bedroom of my son or daughter and let him indoctrinate my child for 6 hours or 60 hours or whatever. You say, listen, you're not getting in my house, no way, over my dead body. But the interesting thing is, so often it'll happen with music, it'll happen with entertainment. They listen to these things, even in the news we see some of the consequences related to these things. They're being indoctrinated. If we will not stir up the heroic and guide the children, this generation, and what is great, and what is highest, there's always someone waiting to pick up who gets missed, and they'll make them a part of their purpose. So Nebuchadnezzar, he understood the importance of youth. He also understood that by taking the cream of the crop from Jerusalem, that he weakened Jerusalem. He didn't just strengthen himself. He weakened Jerusalem at the same time. And he understood that when he gets them young, now you got a lifelong evangelist for Babylon. And so he takes and he grabs a hold of the youth. His methods for indoctrination are very interesting to me in the passage. Number one, he uses flattery and he uses recognition. He wants only the best. He wants only the elite. And he makes sure that they get lots of attention. And they no doubt knew that they were the elite. And now they are getting attention and recognition like they have never had in their lives, materially speaking. I think how often a young person will give their heart, their mind, their soul, their strength to anyone who will give them recognition. It's intoxicating for a young person so often. Who is going to give that person recognition? Who's going to tell them that there's something special? Who's going to see the potential in their life and speak to them about that? The first person in line to do that is going to have a tremendous place in that life. And Nebuchadnezzar sure knew how to try and seduce a life away from God. And I'd say he isn't the last one to try and do it. And he knew how to do it through flattery and recognition. As with Babylon, if you have these characteristics, if you are a younger person or any person, and the world would look at you and say, there is a young man, there is a young woman, there is an older man, there is an older woman in whom there's no blemish, they're good looking, they're wise, they have intelligence, they're able to be educated in the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. If you have those as characteristics of your life, you'll be a target for Babylon. I guarantee you, you'll be a target for Babylon in this world. If you're a believer in the Lord Jesus, and you are so blessed in any of these areas in terms of what you are physically, athletics, looks, what you are mentally, you've got the smarts, you've got all these kinds of things, you're blessed that way, then you've got to recognize, and you're going to need to realize, that you're going to get attention and you're going to be approached by Babylon for its purposes, and to be ready for it, because it's going to happen. It's going to happen. You'll be approached. Sometimes I look at people. You ever look at people? I'm in airports sometimes, and you look at people, and they're too good looking for their own good. You look at them and you go, I feel for you. There's some people who are so smart. They're so intelligent. I mean, they're so gifted in certain areas, and it's just like, you know, that's hard. But sometimes in terms of the physical thing, you can look at a guy or you can look at a woman and you say, that person is just, I mean, that's Darcy out of Pride and Prejudice. Bingley, I understand, if you understand the series. But I mean, here you get these people that just are outrageously good looking, and they are in for an enormous trial in their life unless they recognize that they're going to become the target of attention. They're going to need to handle properly. So the person is going to be approached, and it's coming just like it came to Daniel. And so if God has gifted you in any way that gains you attention concerning attractiveness or concerning your smarts or intelligence or concerning athleticism or these kinds of things that get you attention, then realize that what you've got, you've received from the Lord. Now use it for the glory of the Lord. Submit it to Him. Use it for His glory, to bless Him, to love Him, and to love others. So the first thing he does is he uses flattery and recognition as very powerful in a young person's life. We ought to be speaking good things into our children's lives so they don't have to go someplace else to hear those things. The second thing that he does that's very effective here in a brainwash, conforming kind of a thing is he isolates them. Nebuchadnezzar understands the importance of isolating them from the rest of God's people. So he isolates them from other people that love the Lord. He's isolated them from their roots. He's isolated them from their home. And this is one thing that Satan loves to do, is he loves to isolate God's people. Because it's a very effective way of beginning a process of getting them on ground that's dangerous. Satan will sometimes isolate believers through pride. You're so smart. What do you do gathering with those Christians? I mean, you ought to be the head of a Bible college. Wasting your time there and all that. And sometimes he gets this. He'll come in, start to tell you all these kinds of things. Pride's a very effective way of isolating people from God's people. You know, you don't need that. You're strong enough to make it on your own. You don't have to. It's okay for you to forsake the assembling of the saints. As the writer of the book of Hebrews said, you can stand strong. You don't need the exhortation that comes from contact with the rest of the body, and that person is headed for a big fall. Sometimes Satan will isolate us through condemnation. What are you doing coming to church, you little riffraff boy? After what I saw you do this week, you're going to church. Oh, no, you know. And so he'll come always in that way. There's an interesting way to determine the difference between condemnation, which comes from the devil, and conviction that comes from the Holy Spirit. And there's a difference between the two, because God will never condemn us as a believer. He'll convict us like crazy, but condemnation he'll never do. There is now, therefore, no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus. The condemnation is where someone comes in, a voice comes in and says, listen, what are you doing? After what you did, you ought to lay low for a month and then reintroduce yourself in the church, or that kind of thing. It's always pushing you away from the body of Christ. When the Holy Spirit comes in and convicts of sin, there'll be a sober handling. He won't soft sell the sin. Sober handling of the sin, but then you can't wait to gather with God's people. You can't wait to get around the things of the Lord again. And so here, he isolates them. And isolation is a very, very powerful way of that process. You may be a person here tonight where flattery is being used on you. Isolation is going on. You're being moved away from God's people. Look at what you're being set up for.
This isn't just a series of little circumstances that come up and all. Someone has an end and a plan for your life, and they're working you in that direction. You don't know that it's happening. So you have to be careful of that. The next thing that he uses in verse 5 is indoctrination. He gives them 3 years of what is called an education, but basically it was indoctrination. This was more when he speaks there in verse 5 about the fact that they would have the 3 years of training for them. It wasn't just teaching them. It was done with a desire to indoctrinate them into the Babylonian ways, teaching them the writings of Babylonian, teaching them the language of Babylon. And what's happening here is it's designed here to retrain their minds to think as Babylonians, no longer to think as lovers of the true and the living God, lovers of the creator of the heavens and the earth. No longer wants them to be thinking as Israelites, to change their worldview from that of the Lord and his word to the Babylonians or whatever else it might be. And it's interesting to me how so many of our public and our higher education institutions have become indoctrination centers. They're no longer education centers. They are pure and simple indoctrination centers. You say, what's your evidence? My evidence is because of what they will not allow to be taught. If it doesn't fit their view, it's not allowed in. It's not allowed in. The tolerance is very one way today, isn't it? It's all got to come one way, their way. But once any kind of tolerance is demanded of them, all of a sudden we see how tolerant, intolerant they are. And so if something doesn't fit their view, then they don't allow it in because they don't have a desire for the truth. They don't have a desire for indoctrination. You won't put everything on the table in an attempt to discover what the truth is. You're no longer dealing with education. You're dealing with indoctrination. And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar had in mind for these young people. What he was enlisting them in was an indoctrination center. And much of our education system is the same thing. And notice who they target. They target the youth, just like Nebuchadnezzar did. They target the youth. The parallels are astounding as it relates to modern day. And so, you like the Babylonian school here with Daniel and his three friends, all you have to do to excel in many of these systems today is to submit yourself to their gods and to their worldview. You can excel like crazy. Make a stand, and sometimes it's hard to excel. Now, Daniel is going to excel without compromising. So it can be done. It's a beautiful way that it can be done. So there's the indoctrination that goes on. And then notice what he does there in verse 5. He speaks about the daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine that he drank. So everything that the king ate, all the wine that he drank, that was for them. Remember, Karen and I, we were in a restaurant a while back, and kind of a fun place, and we're sitting there, and the whole room is just filled with older people. And in this little room that we're in and everything. And the guy sitting next to us, I mean, there's just he and his wife, they're a study in two people having been married for 100 years. And but anyway, they're having a nice time together. And you know how you start to look alike after. But anyway, there they are, and they're sitting there and everything. And I heard him order. He was asked if he wanted any wine. He said, yes. I'd like a 1935 Gamay Beaujolais. And basically, I wanted to mention that illustration just so I could say that to you. But I thought to myself, I don't even know. I mean, that's pre-World War II. What does a 1935 bottle of Gamay Beaujolais cost and that kind of a thing? Well, it's here, there, in a place, eating fabulously, wine, that kind of thing. That's the kind of food that was coming to these young men there in Babylon. And what the king is doing here with them is that he is trying to addict them to something that is a dangerous addiction for some people, and that's an addiction to comfort, an addiction to luxury. And here he gives them this fabulous food. And if they're going to eat it for 3 years, at the end of 3 years, what's going to happen?
they're going to feel indebted to do whatever whoever provided that food to me asks me to do. It's a very subtle but very, very strong means of manipulation, removing your ability to say no in a situation is manipulation. And it's especially effective on younger people. So he takes and he uses this food in order to indebt them. And then the second effect was to get them addicted as young people to a life of luxury, a life of comfort. Many lives that will never experience the fullness of God's call upon their life because early in life they got addicted to comfort and addicted to luxury. Jesus said to one man, who a scribe that came to him and said, "Teacher, I'll follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests. The Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Are you willing to live that life? No nest, no holes. We lie down wherever we lie down for the kingdom of God. That's the way that it is. Do you want in? You want in. The guy didn't want in. And there's a lot of people who will never discover the full beauty of the life that God has called for them called to because early in their life they get addicted to ease. As parents, we have to be careful not to addict our children to ease as we're raising them in what is a very affluent time in the United States of America. And so here they are. Here's this idea of, boy, if these people taste of this, if they eat of this, if they experience this ease, they'll never want to go to digging ditches or working on cars or any of that kind of stuff. We'll have them for good. And just like Babylon, Satan comes to many and he uses this luxury, the good life, to try and lure people away from the life that God has called us to. And it's a very subtle attack. That's a very powerful, powerful attack. Wasn't a head-on front with the indoctrination, you know, and here's what you got to think. You can't think as an Israelite anymore, that kind of thing. But it's just as powerful, a quiet, quiet way of getting a life to where I'm unwilling to consider these things because it'll be uncomfortable to me because of the comfort that I've experienced, even though God's will is out there where it is uncomfortable. And so many people, they sell themselves for ease, for security, and for place in society, for promotion. And this was a device that Satan uses and that Nebuchadnezzar used. In verse 5, he attempts to introduce compromise into their lives. And so the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and the wine which he drank. Now, Daniel is going to, he's not going to partake of that. We're going to get to that in just a moment. And so I'll address that. But one of the things that's interesting to notice about Babylon and any system of indoctrination, and we live in a world that's trying to conform us into its image, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. This world is trying to conform us. And so there's this attempt to introduce compromise. The world will always attempt to introduce compromise into our lives in an attempt to see where we stand. It's guaranteed. It's going to happen. Another thing, and the final thing that he does as a part of this whole molding system, is that Nebuchadnezzar has these four men renamed. He changes their names. One of the interesting things about Hebrews naming their children in those days is that the names typically had significance as it related to God's name in some way. You know, it's just Damien. I mean, I don't even know, there's no high significance to that name. My mom just liked the name, so she named me that name. Doesn't mean jackal or anything like that. Doesn't mean Antichrist. Doesn't mean any of those things. Just means good guy, kind of a nice guy. Listen. I think it means listen to him while he's teaching. I think that was the thing on the deal. But
But in those days, they would take and they would give these people names, and the names would have something to do with God. And so here you have Daniel is named, Hananiah is named, Mishael is named, Azariah is named. And you notice in Daniel's name and Mishael's name, the last two letters of their name is El. And what it stood for was Elohim. It was a name for God. In Hananiah and also in Azariah, the two letters AH, it spoke of the name Yahweh. And so Daniel's name, as his parents gave it to him, meant God is my judge. The Lord filled his name. Hananiah's name was Jehovah is gracious. Mishael's name means who is what God is. His name was a question. That's good. That's a good name. Who is what God is? Who is what God is? Get in here! Now you see, and then Azariah, his name means the Lord is help. The Lord is help. That's a wonderful name too, isn't it? So Nebuchadnezzar's got a problem, does he? He's got to change their names. Because every time anyone called their name, they'd remember their roots of their family and their relationship to the Lord. So he doesn't want them, he doesn't want Daniel hearing his name all the time. And every time he does, he hears God is my judge. And his mind goes back to Jerusalem, the, you know, God of the Bible and these kinds of things. So he has to change their name. And so Daniel's name is changed to Belteshazzar, which means Bel, which was a god of Babylon. Bel, protect my life. Ananias' name was changed to Shadrach, which means I am fearful of God. It's a perky name. And then Mishael's name was changed to Meshach, and it means I am despised before my God. And then Azariah. So don't think your name's the worst. You could have been called something different. Azariah's name was changed to Abednego, which means the servant of Nebo. And what they're doing here in the changing of names is they're cutting them off from their godly heritage. Those parents named those kids and included Yahweh's name, Jehovah's name, in their name with the hopes that they would grow into their names. They would grow into the godliness of those names, to the majestic character of those names. That was why the parents named their kids those names. And the kids knew that. And every time they'd hear their name, they'd remember, this is mom's faith. This is dad's faith. This is what they believe. What am I doing over here in Babylon and this whole education thing that they're doing in here? And so Nebuchadnezzar knew that he had to change their names in an attempt to cut them off from their godly heritage, to stop them from thinking about their parents and to remove any kind of reminder of God. And Nebuchadnezzar knew you can't brainwash them if they're hearing God's name every time you call their name. Now, here they're probably, these three are probably 14 years old or somewhere like that. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away from home. And you take a young person, take them hundreds of miles away from home. Number one, they're going to be intimidated by the powers that be. And not only are they going to be intimidated, but there's also going to be a tremendous temptation when these things are put in front of them. And the whole world's being offered to these four. They're being offered incredible opportunities, incredible careers. They're being offered positions of influence, positions of power. They're being offered lifelong financial security. They're being offered education. They're being offered the best food and drink in the existence of the world at that time. And so here they are, exposed to this very powerful series of things designed to wear down their resistance and the resistance of even the strongest of people in order to get them to compromise concerning their God. And the interesting thing is that they're completely unsuccessful in their attempt to fashion and to conform Daniel and his friends. And there's one reason that they failed. What kept Daniel? In verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies or with the wine which he drank,
nor with the wine. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed you your food and drink. For why should he see your faces worse than the young men who are your age, when then you would endanger my head before the king? And so Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then let our countenances be examined before you and the countenances of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. And so he consented with them, this ruler of the eunuchs, in this matter, tested them 10 days and the eating of the vegetables and the water. And at the end of the 10 days, their countenance, that is their face and the fullness of their face, appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. And thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. And as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill and all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the end of this indoctrination period, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and then the king interviewed them, and among them all none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king, and all the matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. And thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus, all the way through his ministry. What kept Daniel and his friends was a purpose of heart. And I want you to notice in that verse 8, that first word, but. As the old saying goes, in a counseling session or when you're talking with someone and they're laying out sometimes a very long story, one of the words that you're listening for is but. You lay the whole thing out and then they'll say, but, and typically what that means is forget everything I just said. Now we're getting down to brass tacks. And when God uses the word but there in verse 8, it means that what happens in Daniel's life here, forget everything that came before it. It couldn't withstand before what was going on here in Daniel's life. All that indoctrination, all the temptation, God encapsulates it just in that word, but. It had no chance in the face of what came next. And what came next was Daniel purposed in his heart that he wasn't going to defile himself with the king's meat and with the king's drink. The drink and the meat of the Babylonians that were being served to them was probably defiling in the sense that it wasn't kosher. It wasn't according to the law, Levitical law, so it would have been defiling to them based upon the law. And all of the meals of the Babylonians and the foods that made up the meals, certainly the meats and the wines, were offered to idols, the gods of the Babylonians. So on two counts, Daniel looks and says, I can't partake of that. That would be compromise, and I would be defiled not supremely with the food. I would be defiled with compromise in my conscience before God. And so he refused to partake of it. One of the things that is very interesting to me about all of this is how often the battle is won or lost in the realm of the heart. Won or lost in the realm of the will. It's interesting how the heart has a way of winning out over the mind over a long enough period of time. You can have a person who has mountains and tons of information in their mind about the things of God, and if they have a small division in their heart related to sin, given enough time, that division in their heart will win out over all they know in their head. And it's repeated all the time. It's staggering how you can take someone, they know so much, you put it all over on the scale here, it reaches all the way into the heavens in terms of what's in their head,
Say, nothing could challenge that. Nothing could move them from that. And you just take a division of heart that's the size of a quarter, put it on the other scale, and just wait. Before it's all over, what is in the heart will win. Lot's wife is an example of that in the Old Testament. On the night before Sodom was going to be destroyed, the angels came in, grabbed Lot, said, you got to get out of here. The city's going to be judged. God's going to pour his judgment out upon it. And he spoke to Lot. Lot's wife heard the different things, tried to gather the family together, tried to get her out of there. And as they're running out of the city there and getting away before the destruction of the city the next day, she turns and she looks back at Sodom. And in looking back at Sodom, she was turned to a pillar of salt, or literally a pillar of ash. She became physically what Sodom became in its judgment. But the fascinating thing is what she knew. She knew the city was going to be destroyed. She knew that angelic beings had come to deliver the message. She knew they were angels. She knew all of the truth about what the angels had said. She had a mountain of knowledge. And yet for all of that knowledge, her heart won. The reason she turned back to Sodom is because her heart was in Sodom. And the reason they couldn't move Daniel's heart to Babylon is because his heart was in Jerusalem. His heart was God's. And later on in this book, as they capture him with his godly conduct, he goes into his room. He opens up the window towards Jerusalem. He gets on his knees and he prays towards Jerusalem to the Lord. Everything they did, the mountains of information, was powerless before what his heart was given to. The heart wins out. The heart wins out. And that's why we must be careful what we purpose in our heart. And it doesn't happen automatically. He purposed in his heart that he would not be defiled with the king's meat. And it takes purpose of heart to stand as a child of God in this world. You just can't roll with just anything and everything that happens here. It takes that purpose of heart in order to stand. The writer of the book of Proverbs said, keep your heart with all diligence. Proverbs 4:23, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. No one can have a divided heart as a child of God and ever finish the race that God has put in front of us. What was true of Daniel is true of us. Peter wrote, and he said in 2 Peter 3:11, therefore, since all these things shall be dissolved, where are we going to plant our heart? Therefore, since all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of the Lord, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Is my heart there? Is my heart there? Or am I being indoctrinated by the Babylon that is all around us? You know, life is an endless series of decisions. Every decision puts me on a road. Every road has an end. Every road has an end. And I need to make the right decisions. I need a purpose in my heart, where I'm going to go, what I'm going to put, what path I'm going to put myself on. And so the issue, the king's delicacies and the king's wine, he said, I'm not going to have anything to do with it. It would be compromise to me. And the key to not being defiled by sin or compromise in this world is purpose of heart. I need to make a decision that my life is the Lord's. There comes a point in time in my life where I settle the issue of his lordship in my life. It's very simple. It doesn't have to be a big, loud thing. Just a quiet surrender. Lord, I'm yours, heart, mind, soul, and strength. And Daniel did it early in life. And because he did, he could withstand all that came against him. Notice with me, and just a couple little things while we close up here. Notice that Daniel
made his uncompromising stand at the beginning of things. He made it right at the beginning. He didn't wait till he was 20 years in and then said, all right, I need to make a stand for the Lord. He made a stand for the Lord right away. It is always a self-deception to think, I'm going to compromise now in order to get established here in this place and get ahead a little bit. And then when I have a position of significance, then I'll go ahead and make a stand for the Lord. It never happens. It never happens. What I am now, I will be more of later, no matter what position that I might have. And if I do get ahead, where I say, lay low as it relates to compromise, I compromise to get ahead here, compromise to get ahead there, compromise to get ahead there, and then I get this position, and now I'm going to talk about the Lord to everyone. Everyone will just look and say, get away from me. You crunched the Lord's name every step of the way. Now you got what you wanted, and now you're going to talk to me about the Lord. Forget it. I have no voice once I get there. It's an illusion. It's an illusion. There is no easier time to make a stand for the Lord than right now. And in the different situations that we find ourselves in, to make a stand as it relates to compromise, first thing, it'll never be easier than to do it the first thing. Doesn't mean I have to come up and grab someone's hand and say, hi, my name is Jamie, come aboard again, Christian, that whole thing. But I mean, here I'm walking with the Lord, sensitive to the Lord, situation comes up where it's compromised, and I say, I can't do that. I can't do that. And if I give in there and then I try and not, and then draw a line a little bit later, it only gets harder. And I think many of us in this room have experienced that progression, however few the steps might be. There's never easier than to just do it right at the beginning. It only gets more difficult if I wait. Another thing that I notice here that's very instructive for us, I went an hour this morning, we'll just go 4 or 5 hours tonight. I am closing. That's sick. That's sick pastor humor on my part. I'm sorry about that. Notice in at the end of verse 8, very interesting to notice Daniel's humility and his modesty, even though he was uncompromising. Notice that therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Sometimes when we're wanting to be uncompromising, you know, we become like these fires. I'll tell you, you're trying to get me to compromise. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to take you down and never Lord, I gave you a lot to work with in that situation, and I just asked you to go ahead and bring glory to yourself on that. Here's the tendency is for those of us, some of us who are sons of thunder, who have a real desire to be uncompromising, is that once we are uncompromising, we don't do it in a gentle and a humble way. And Daniel comes in, and he does it in a gentle way, and he does it in a humble way. And I'll tell you, God gets a lot of mileage out of that when there is that unwillingness to compromise, but it's done in that kind of a way. Well, in verse 10, the chief of these eunuchs, he balks at Daniel's idea of not, eating the food. He says, Nebuchadnezzar is going to kill me. I've been given the job of fattening you up so you look good in there. And if you don't look good, I'm going to have my head is going to be taken off. And Daniel gives the proposal of the vegetables and the test of the 10 days. The beautiful thing in verses 14 through 21 is that the Lord honors their stand. He supernaturally comes in and he rewards the stand that they make. God's just looking for a chance to show himself strong on our behalf if we'll stand completely for him. And he blesses them physically, verses 14 through 16, he blesses them in wisdom and understanding. And then that beautiful word there, the first word of verse 22, and thus Daniel continued. He began uncompromising, and because he began that way, he continued uncompromising in his faith for the Lord. And only because he was uncompromising at the beginning, only because of that did he discover the life that God had for him. One of the real tragedies of compromise in our lives is that when we live that life, we'll never experience the life that God has for us. We'll experience the life that other people have for us, or the life that we have for us, but that never compares to the life that he has for us. The lessons here for the passage. God is sovereign, and he is at work even in the most difficult circumstances of our lives. He's at work. It takes a little while to see it, but he's at work, and he's trustworthy at those kinds of times. He was at work in Daniel's life. Just looked a little scary for a while. He's at work in our lives. Can look a little scary for a while. The second lesson is that the world is trying to fashion us, trying to mold us, but it can never be successful when there is a purpose of heart for God. The world has plans for us. Babylon has plans for us. But God also has plans for us. And only by not compromising purpose of heart can we ever enjoy and experience that life. Are you here tonight with a divided heart? Is the heart winning out all of the time? Some little thing that's in there that's always winning. I mean, you know the Bible inside of that. You've memorized the navigators, all this kind of stuff. I mean, you got information like crazy. But there's not that purpose of heart. You can settle that tonight. The Lordship of the Lord Jesus. Get that purpose of heart tonight to say, Lord, I want to experience the life that you have for me. The rest of the way, I want to experience that. And God will honor that prayer, and he will, by his Spirit, work in our lives to make that prayer come to pass. He hears our cries.